Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Modiwa Gabaza, and for today, we're getting into a conversation about the state of the economy in August 2024. We are recording this in the week of the 14th, and we're just going to be chatting with the team from Momentum, just to give us a sense of what they are seeing in the economy. They recently did some research, giving us a perspective of what the economy looks like at a glance at July 2024, that was last month. So to make sense of it all for us, we are joined by someone who's no stranger to the platform, but someone that we haven't spoken to in quite some time, admittedly, and that is Sanisha Pakirasamy, who is the chief economist over at Momentum Investments Group. Sanisha, greetings to you today.
Thanks so much, Madhu. It's great to be on the platform again with you.
I think where I will begin today, Sanisha, is maybe you heard us at the beginning talking about getting a pulse check in August 2024. Right now, where you are, because, the economy can be this big nebulous thing, right? But if you were to maybe summarize, I'm going to, just to keep it brief, maybe two things in August 2024 that you would say characterize the market or the environment that we find ourselves in.
Sure. So I think you could actually maybe even narrow down to one main thing that will encompass a couple of points, and that is the market wobble that we saw at the beginning of last week. And I think, there were quite a few market jitters that came through in the financial market sphere on the back of some poorer jobs data that came through from the United States economy. Now, up until this point, I would say that, the central scenario across the board for many investors was that we are going to end up with some sort of soft landing scenario in the global economy following quite a long period of interest rate hikes over a relatively short period of time. However, I think this, general thesis was pushed a bit to the brink and tested at the beginning of the week last week on the back of poorer jobs data, starting to see some cracks emerging in the consumer-related indicators in the U.S. And once again, we started hearing murmurings of a potential hard landing or recession. Now, saying that, I would still suggest that going forward, the expectation for a soft landing is still the prominent central scenario. And here I can refer to the Merrill Lynch fund manager survey, where they ask global investors across the world, what is the most likely outcome for the global economy in the next 12-month period? Are we going to be experiencing, no landing, so everything carries on as it is, a soft landing, a hard landing where there's more of a recessionary impact, or maybe they just don't know. And even though the percentage that rated this as a hard landing increased a bit to 13%, predominantly the majority of investors are still anticipating a soft landing to come through. And if we look at the growth numbers out there, at the margin, we're not seeing any further upward revisions to growth in places like the US and China, but we are still seeing some upward revisions to growth in places like the UK and the Eurozone as a composite. And on the inflation side of things, the last couple of months, even into July, which would have then been the print that came out for August, is some softening of the pace of disinflation. So even though inflation continues to fall worldwide, the pace at which it's falling has been slowing, and that's because services inflation has remained quite sticky.
One of the things that I'm maybe keen to get your sense on, Sanisha, is right now, one of the other things that people have been worried about is to say that central bankers have perhaps taken a little bit too long to start softening their stance on interest rates. And by that, we're specifically talking about, at least within our context, talking about the SARB and also talking about the US Fed, right? Because we have already seen some movement in places like, like Europe. Do you think there's any credence to
Thanks so
that,
much, Madhu. It's
or do
great to
you
be
think
on the
the
platform again with
if we're
you.
going to call it a glide path, that the glide path that had been set, is probably still relevant and the way, to go for a central bank like the SARB?
Sure. So I think, it's a bit premature to call out the United States Federal Reserve as, making a monetary policy mistake by not moving yet. I think we just don't have enough prints to suggest that the economy is in fact, moving into a much softer growth pattern. And I think, the next couple of months worth of data will give us some evidence, either supporting that or against that view. And I think we also need to remember that during the period of the COVID-19 pandemic, we had a very synchronized global economy. Authorities at central banks were moving in the same direction and in similar magnitudes on interest rate policy. And we also saw that, fiscal easing to support the economy was also happening across the globe in quite a coordinated response. However, since the COVID-19 pandemic, there have been varied growth outcomes. There have been varied inflation outcomes. And so we sat with a case where output gaps and inflation gaps were looking quite different across the globe. So to take the extreme, if we look at somewhere like China, they had a negative growth gap and a negative inflation gap, which actually then suggested that they should start, continue easing policy. And then on the opposite end of that spectrum, we had the likes of Australia and the US economy, where growth was still looking reasonably robust, but they were still quite concerned about inflation. And so this is really why the US Federal Reserve held off from easing interest rate policy too soon, because they were quite worried that inflation would then get a second wind and start creeping back into the economy. Now, the likes of the Bank of England and even if we look at the European Central Bank, we're sitting with a very different kind of combination of output gaps and inflation gaps. So they were still experiencing a positive inflation gap, so inflation higher than the central bank target, but they were also sitting with a negative output gap. In other words, growth falling below its potential. And so if they didn't cut interest rates before the Fed, they risked that growth conundrum becoming a much larger factor for the central banks in those respective jurisdictions to tackle. And so that's essentially why we saw some monetary policy easing coming through for the likes of the BOE and the ECB. Well, the Fed, because growth was performing reasonably well up until a certain point, were actually allowed to still, keep interest rate policy on hold. Now, I think by and large across the globe, we have seen that central banks have changed tack. So initially, their stance was to aggressively fight inflation at all costs, and all costs, including what happened to things like employment or growth. But I think now, given that we are starting to see some cracks emerging in the global economy, in terms of economic activity, as a consequence of very tight monetary policy in many jurisdictions, is that they're now starting to focus on promoting economic stability. And so, by and large, if we look at the number of central banks that are cutting globally, this is now starting to outweigh the number of central banks that are still hiking interest rates across the globe.
So with that in mind then, Sinisha, because like you said, we had found ourselves in a very interesting moment where you use the concept of synchronicity, to say that it's one of the few times in modern history at least where you find a common set of issues that central bankers are dealing with. Usually these things are either regional or country specific, or maybe because of some big geopolitical event, but especially because of COVID, it was unison in terms of the strife or the issues that people were facing. Now that we are where we are now, what do you make of I guess South Africa's stance there? There has been a lot of criticism leveled at the SARB. You said it maybe it's a bit premature to make a judgment on the US, but when it comes to the SARB, there has been quite a bit of criticism leveled against that body, to say that perhaps they've been a little bit too stringent in the approach on one end, whereas on the other side, you have people saying that, well, we're expecting too much, you know, from a central bank, and that there are other levers that need to be pulled apart from monetary policy to get South Africa moving again.
If we look at South Africa, you know, I think that we obviously don't operate in isolation, and we do take global trends into account. And it's not to say that the South African Reserve Bank follows the US Fed one for one. I think where that link actually happens is the implication for global capital flows. And I think that's really the important starting point, how that affects the currency, how that then feeds through into inflation expectations, and then making, you know, a judgment call on interest rate policy. The fact that there's a lot of pressure, I think, coming from financial markets to ease monetary policy in SA is also not unique. I think we're seeing, you know, quite a lot of pressure from financial markets across the globe. And that was, you know, one of the things that came out of the market wobbles that we saw at the beginning of last week, was that interest rate expectations adjusted across the globe. So for the US Fed, as an example, you know, a couple of weeks ago, there were between one and two interest rate cuts that were penciled in terms of the Fed fund futures curve. And after those market wobbles, between four and five interest rate cuts were penciled in before the year was up. And so, you know, that just shows you how financial markets then got onto that bandwagon of much weaker growth prospects and central banks having to react to that. Now, in South Africa, because we are a small open economy, you know, we have to factor in how the currency movements shift in line with global risk aversion. So when those market wobbles happened globally, our South African currency actually sold off. And with the weaker currency, if it's sustained for a prolonged period of time, that could then negatively impact our inflation outlook, because it means that things like imported inflation then become higher. And with those inflation expectations starting to de-anchor on the back of a sustained period of rand weakness, it then threatens the outlook for the inflation targeting mandate. And so I think, you know, that heralds a period of sort of caution from the central bank. So I think up until, you know, this point in time, even though there is this pressure on the central bank to ease monetary policy, they're also looking at it from the perspective of whether or not inflation expectations become de-anchored. In the South African experience, we've seen that food and fuel price pressures have largely came into the basket and washed out again. Unfortunately, we didn't have the same experience on services inflation that many of our global counterparts actually experienced. So across the globe, we saw that services inflation picked up quite steadily, and we saw broader based inflationary pressures creeping into other areas of these economies on a global scale. In South Africa, we did have services inflation picking up a little, but there was no real evidence of a wage price spiral. In other words, wages then reacting to higher inflation, and it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy on inflation. And as a result of that, we've seen relatively contained services inflation, although it has ticked up in the last couple of readings. And add to that, we've also had that our inflation expectations, and this is calibrated by the Bureau for Economic Research on a five-year basis, have actually come back to that 4.5% target. So based on those factors of food and fuel inflation coming back, services inflation dribbling higher, but not in a significant way, and the fact that inflation expectations have sort of come back to the midpoint of the target range intimates then that the South African Reserve Bank should have some policy space to cut interest rates. And so our own internal view is for a 25 basis point cut in September and November, and a potential another two in the first half of next year. I think there are a couple of caveats to that. Of course, if we see, you know, further market wobbles on the back of softer than expected data in the global economy, that could cause a bout of risk off. That could then feed negatively into the currency. And if the currency, you know, stays on the back foot for a protracted period of time, that would then be a significant risk to inflation expectations. And I think that would then keep you know, that caution element at play for our own central bank.
Sanisha, one of the things I'm quite curious about is what you've just said now about market wobbles and a potential sell-off of the rand. And I ask that simply because when you read some of the experiences of what happened last week, softer expectation in the US, one would think that a softer expectation in the US would actually weaken the US currency and perhaps strengthen the rand. For perhaps for the uninitiated, if you could explain some of the dynamics at play there.
Sure. So I think it's a little bit unique to the US circumstance because the US dollar is still the world's reserve currency and it does act as a safe haven, as do other currencies like the Swiss franc in some cases, and even the asset class like gold. And so when you get a bout of risk off, so markets or the economy looking a lot weaker than what people were anticipating, you find that investors would want to either keep capital at home and not really want to readily deploy that capital into perceived riskier assets. And emerging market assets are generally seen to be the riskier asset classes, including the currencies like the South African rand. And so you almost have a little bit of a counterintuitive effect playing out, that when you have a bout of risk off with maybe potentially softer than expected data out of the US, you still have that global capital staying at home. So money not leaving, the US shores to go find higher returns elsewhere because they perceive the risk out there to be quite high.
Okay, I think it makes sense when you put it like that. I always find that when you talk about the US economy, there's a lot of economic theory that sort of goes counter to what people would normally expect to happen.
100%. And I think it's because the US still holds the world's reserve currency status. So, I mean, another one of those anomalies is the US debt situation, right? So, I mean, we often complain in the South African context, the rate at which our debt to GDP numbers deteriorated and the level that it is at. And, we almost sometimes forget what has happened in the US economy, where debt levels are also quite high. But you're not really seeing, the US economy being punished in the same way for those extreme debt levels, again, because the US still holds the world's reserve currency, being the US dollar.
Yeah, very true. And I think one could also argue the same around the amount of liquidity that has been pumped into that economy over the years, particularly in COVID years. Yes, we saw a bit of we saw inflation running up a bit, but for any other market it probably would have run up way more than it probably did for the US. But when it comes to some of those dynamics, one of the other things that has happened in 2024, which is common for the South African economy, the US economy, and a number of economies around the world, including France and the UK, is elections. We started off the year with an expectation of about, I think, 70 elections around the world, and we've seen how some of those have played out so far in 2024. The US one is probably the most anticipated at the end of the year. South Africa has gone over its hump as of May. Now that there's a GNU in place, how are we feeling now that the dust has settled a little bit? A lot of uncertainty going into May. A lot of uncertainty coming out of the election and trying to decide how are these parties going to partner. But now that things are settled in terms of what the government looks like, where are we now a couple of months on?
I don't think that this is going to be, sort of a straight line from here. So I like how you said, the dust has settled, but I think you might get, another boot in the sand a couple of months down the line and some more dust comes out again. And I think that's really going to be the trajectory for South Africa. We are, in largely uncharted territory here. And I think with the government of national unity, there are a lot of pros. Given that you do get more support from citizens because the government that is representing those citizens now represents a much wider array of factions. And as so far as, leadership is unified, it can then focus on collective problem solving, particularly to address the socioeconomic issues that we face as a country. So with that diversity of views, it also then brings some cons into the process. And that means that it can take much longer to actually, you know, form broad-based agreement on issues. And so that could lead to an even slower implementation of policy reforms. And we know that this was a bugbear in terms of policymaking in SA, where it wasn't really the policies, you know, that were viewed negatively, but the fact that they were not implemented fast enough. And with the government of national unity, it might take even longer to do that, because having all these different ideological backgrounds can potentially pose an additional challenge to reaching a broad-based consensus. And so further down the line, I think, you know, once we have all that euphoria kind of dying down, we do need to see that there's more shared responsibility for policy outcomes. We need to see some compromise in order to see some focus on the policies coming out from SA. And I think, you know, there would be medium-term challenges down the line as some of these parties now then try to further their own policy agendas. I think in the short term, there's been, you know, almost a sense of goodwill. You know, I mean, just anecdotally, people feel quite optimistic about the government of national unity, at least at a national level. We know we've got some issues locally. But I think that that business and consumer sentiment could potentially pick up on just, you know, general hopes of a continuation in structural reform efforts that can then lead to an improved economic growth trajectory for the country. I think a lot of that will then depend on, you know, the relative success of projects like Operation Vulindlela, the project office that sits within the presidency to reduce the regulatory red tape in areas of the economy that are vital to growth in South Africa. But we also need to also acknowledge the fact that since the global financial crisis, GDP per capita and growth there has actually been slightly negative. And so, you know, overall, we have dug a bit of an economic hole for ourselves in the last couple of years, and it will take some time to get out of that hole. And so in the short term, you know, we still have the view that we would grow around 1% this year, around 1.7% next year. But I think the fruits of those structural reform efforts will then start to have a more positive impact on growth further down the line. And so when I talk about our medium-term growth prospects, we've got quite a favorable view on the economic outlook. And I think it's quite achievable to get to that 2.5-3% mark on a 3 to 5 year timeframe. However, the near term is still then constrained by ongoing issues in the transport sector, as an example, in terms of the railways and ports, you know, water outages, etc. So finally, we're seemingly getting over the electricity shortage hump with, you know, collective effort between the private sector and government. And I think with more of that on the cards in various sectors of the economy, we should start to see a more positive growth trajectory coming out from here.
When it comes to that outlook, you mentioned just now that there is a lot of goodwill in the market. Have you seen any movement, whether it's in terms of data or anecdotally from business, you know, perhaps loosening up some of their own purse strings, because a lot of companies had sort of taken a wait and watch approach before making certain capital allocation decisions before elections? Are we seeing the needle moving in the business sector on that front, or there hasn't been too much movement yet?
Because I think we'll probably get a little bit more, you know, evidence of that coming out when we get the third quarter GDP data. So I know, you know, at the time of the recording of our podcast now, we don't have the second quarter GDP data, but I think that's going to show reasonable softness in the construction and fixed investment side, because it did coincide with the national elections that happened in May. And I think people were holding off because they were very uncertain about how the elections would pan out. I think we've seen, you know, quite a bit of investment coming through in the renewable space, but I think we'll see more going forward in terms of the logistics space as those regulations ease up and as private sector participation increase. I'm also expecting that to happen a little bit more in the water industry. I think, you know, we were earlier on, we were talking about interest rates being a constraining factor for the economy, maybe a bit more so on the consumer side for the consumers that are heavily indebted. But I think it's not the leading cause of concern on your business side of things. So I think what was a bigger constraining factor there was the fact that we had uncertainty in the political climate. And again, the Bureau for Market Research in their manufacturing survey actually asks manufacturers what are the main reasons that they don't want to invest in the economy. And for quite some time now, the number one leading reason, above things like, you know, availability of labor and enough demand in the economy, was essentially the uncertainty of that political climate in SA. And I think, you know, the last data point that we got, we saw that coming off just a little bit. But going forward, as we see, you know, some of the low-hanging fruit being tackled by the Government of National Unity and more clarity on structural reform efforts from here on out and an improvement in things like, you know, corruption efforts, et cetera, we will start to see that metric come lower. And once we see that metric come lower, we would then expect to see a further acceleration on the investment side. If we think about what's happened to, you know, the manufacturing and the mining sector, we had reasonably poor data coming out from there, despite the fact that we haven't had that much or actually no load shedding in the last while. And that tells me that the, you know, the focus of companies right now is almost on a sort of cost-cutting mission, and they are still experiencing some challenges in those various sectors of the economy. So I think it'll take a bit of time for us to see some movement there. And it will largely depend on whether or not the Government of National Unity uses this period of goodwill to try and, you know, score some goals early on as they try to collaborate and reach consensus on sort of your early quick gains that they can get from the economy.
You know, when you are talking about the outlook and sort of looking at what's going on in the space, right? You almost get the sense that, like you said, there's a lot of goodwill, you know, in the market. But like you said, it's more over time that people will make proper determinations about whether or not the moment has been seized and used in the way that it was meant to, you know, to your point just now. The other stakeholder when it comes to that, because we've got the internal, you know, you've got the internal piece, which is your consumers, businesses, government, and you know how they're seeing things developing on the ground. But the other important factor to an earlier point you made about South Africa being a small and open economy is the global view. Is there any indication, you know, from the ratings agencies around what direction they might be, you know, moving in terms of their assessments of what's going on? One would have expected, or one would at least expect, that solving, you know, part of the political, you know, stalemate would have done well in at least helping to improve some of those global perceptions.
I think this might be, you know, one of those cases that, you know, the proof is in the pudding. So, you know, if we look at the ratings and where we are at currently, I think one of the reasons that we were downgraded to these levels was the fact that we do have an elevated debt burden, and especially the servicing of that debt. So if you think about every rand that government collects in revenue, 20 cents is going out to actually service that interest bill, which means that that money can't be used on other socioeconomic priorities like, you know, building houses or schools or hospitals. And so that is still, you know, a major sticking point, I think, for the rating agencies. I think if we could continue on the path of fiscal prudence, and I think, you know, the marginal changes in the Cabinet Ministry of Finance suggest that we will still stick to a prudent fiscal path, that might be enough to actually get us to a positive outlook on our sovereign rating during the course of 2025. But I think actual rating upgrades may be a 2026 and further out story, because that will then rely on whether or not we are actually seeing the fruits of those structural reform efforts positively affecting growth, whether we are actually seeing expenditure restraint positively impacting the debt to GDP trajectory and our fiscal numbers.
All right. So that's where we, land today's conversation. It's always great talking to and picking the brain of someone like Sanisha, giving us some insight into what the South African economy is dealing with right now, especially within the context of a global economy that, to use her words, just underwent a wobble about a week ago because some of the expectations haven't gone the way that people thought they were gonna go. Classic case where the US economy catches a cold, and everyone else feeling those effects. She was also highlighting the fact that we will, start to see, some of the softening, when it comes to monetary policy and that type of thing. But, South Africa specifically, they expect that we're going to see, a couple of rate cuts before, the end of the year. She says that it's too early, to make a call about whether or not, the US specifically had been, too late, to pull the trigger on that particular front, and then also giving us some insight into what it's into some of the I don't want, I'm just going to use the word idiosyncrasies, but some of the stuff that is counterintuitive, rather, around the US economy and some of the impacts of certain events and how sentiment for risk on and risk off sentiment actually affects an emerging market, such as South Africa. So she actually says that things are positive right now, but if we do see maybe another wobble, that's one of those things that would likely not bode well for emerging markets as a whole, and in turn, an economy such as South Africa. Also getting into what's been happening with the government of national unity, highlighting that we have a period of goodwill and that it is a great moment to be in. But, the proof, as she said, is going to be in the pudding. How do policymakers, how do businesses make use of, this moment that we're in so that we start, printing, successive quarters of growth and then over time improve the overall growth outlook for the country, so that we can, achieve that close to 2%, in coming years, and leave this one and less than 1% territory that the South African economy has been existing in. Sanisha, anything else before we let you go?
I think I'm all good, Mudiwa. It was lovely catching up on the economy again.
Definitely. So that was us, and we were in conversation with Sanisha Pakenrasami. She is the chief economist over at Momentum Investments Group. Sanisha, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Madiba.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.